The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, good morning. This morning I wanted to, I'd like to give a little bit of a Zen-inspired teaching. And, you know, I think Buddhist teachings can be presented from many different perspectives, often pointing to a similar teaching, similar idea. And I spent a lot of the years practicing Zen, and so it comes out sometimes. So I thought I would, it's on my mind. And it includes telling a story, because I don't think there's religions without stories. And Zen has a lot of stories. And this one I think of as a fable. And when you hear it, you'll probably agree that it's probably more like a fable than a historical account. But to introduce it, I would like to quote the Zen master Dogen, a very important Zen teacher in Japan in the 1200s. And in one of his famous writings, he wrote that Buddhas are enlightened about delusion. Foolish people are deluded about enlightenment. And I certainly noticed that when people are new to practice, and also sometimes, you know, idealistic, there's a great interest in enlightenment, and who is enlightened, and, you know, I'm going to get enlightened, or, you know, when I get enlightened, then I'll live happily ever after, or or I'll get the badge that I can go around and show people that I'm a successful person, or whatever. And but a variety of interest in enlightenment, and I've noticed that as people mature in practice, many people get less and less interested in the topic of enlightenment, the more mature they are, and find themselves more just being content to just be who they are, be as they are, and deal with delusions, deal with attachments as they come up, and understand the nature of those. And that seems to support them more to be free than it is to kind of keep focusing on the ideal of enlightenment itself. And, I know a lot of Buddhist practitioners have been practicing, some of them for close to 50 years, 50 years, and more than 50 years, some of them I know. And one of the things that characterizes them is they're very relaxed about their foibles, their so-called shortcomings. You know, they have them, but they're not defensive around them, or they're not upset about having them. They're not, they're responsible for them. They engage with them. They practice with them, for sure. But sometimes they're so easy to kind of say, admit, you know, oh, this is, you know, I have this quirk. I do this thing, but they don't seem to be caught by it or pushed around by it, or they seem, but they're also not, you know, they're not embarrassed by it or defended by it. It's just like, oh, you know, and this ease and willingness just to be and be someone who has maybe shortcomings, or they're not stellar examples of, you know, spiritual Olympians. So to be enlightened about delusion instead of deluded about enlightenment. So there's the story. It seems to be that once upon a time, there was a great gathering of Buddhas to have a Buddha conference. And I'm not sure what Buddhas do when they come together for conferences, but Buddhist teachers often have meetings. You know, it's part of the nature is to get together and talk about teaching and the issues that come up. So these Buddhas had a big conference, but not invited to this meeting were the bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are beings that are not really human anymore. They're kind of like, they're sometimes called celestial as opposed to deities. But they're the most highly developed beings, just short of being a Buddha. And some of them embody certain characteristics, certain good qualities. And one of them is Manjushri. And Manjushri is the bodhisattva, the celestial being, that personifies wisdom. It's the great wisdom, bodhisattva. So the bodhisattvas were not invited to this conference of Buddhas. So maybe that's okay. And however, when it was over, all the Buddhas except for Shakyamuni Buddha left. Shakyamuni Buddha being the Buddha of our kind of, our Buddha. And so then Manjushri went into the place, and sitting there next to Shakyamuni Buddha was, in a place of honor right next to him, was a woman. And the woman was sitting in samadhi, in deep state of concentration. So Manjushri said to Shakyamuni, you know, what's a woman doing in the place of honor, sitting in samadhi, when this was supposed to be a conference of just Buddhas, and the bodhisattvas were not even invited? So, it's maybe a little bit misogynist. And there is that streak in all cultures, right? So Buddhism has it as well. But Zen kind of pushes against that misogyny sometimes. And this is, I think, one example of that playing itself out. So Manjushri said, what is she doing sitting up there in the place of honor? And so the Buddha says, well, why don't you ask her? And so, but she's sitting in samadhi, meaning some deep state of concentration. And so he goes and he walks around her three times, usually something you do out of respect, and snaps his fingers. And tries to get her to come out of a samadhi, and nothing works. He can't get her out. So he says that to the Buddha, it's not working. Why can't I get her out? And then the Buddha said, well, there is a great bodhisattva deep down underneath in some far distant place. Oh, no. And then, I meant to tell the story a little bit more. So he tries to snap her fingers and get her out. And he also tries to, he also lifts her up into the air. Because Manjushri has great psychic powers. So he lifts her up into the air, and she's up there. But he still can't get her to come out of samadhi. So then the Buddha said, well, there is this other bodhisattva, far in the deep realms below us, called the bodhisattva wisdom about delusion. Let's see what she can do. So she comes up out of the ground, out of the earth, and she goes and stands in front of the woman in samadhi and sits down in front of her and bows and snaps her fingers, and the woman comes out of samadhi. That's the end of the story. So this is a koan. It's a koan that's in a book called The Gateless Gate. It's also a nice, wonderful title. The Gateless Gate. So it's the gate we're supposed to walk through to become liberated. But it's gateless. There's no gate. So how do you walk through a gate where there's no gate? The Gateless Gate. So there's a whole bunch of these stories like that. And then Zen students sometimes will take one of these stories and live with it for a while and reflect on it and then try to present their response, their reaction, their understanding of it to their teacher. So, what is your understanding? What comments do you have about this story? What do you think is going on there?
I noticed that the bodhisattva that came from down below was depicted as female, And she didn't diss the woman in samadhi like in Manjushri did.
Like, why aren't you, you know, the person of great wisdom, but, you know, he didn't have the wisdom to say it was okay for a woman to be sitting there. Maybe, okay.
So the bodhisattva from way down below was the bodhisattva wisdom
about
delusion. And so I was wondering if bringing the woman out of samadhi was bringing her from a place of non-delusion into delusion, or maybe the other way around. And I haven't formed an opinion one way or the other about that.
Uh-huh. Great. So is the woman sitting in samadhi, was there some kind of delusion in being in samadhi or not? And if she was in delusion, was the bodhisattva about delusion bringing her out of her delusion? Or was she not in delusion, but the bodhisattva about delusion brought a handful of delusion along and got her deluded? Yes, Trudy. Is there a mic over there, that side? Oh, yes.
Well, it seems to me that the male monk who tried and failed to bring her out of samadhi was in delusion as to his attainment of a certain level. And he was operating from some sort of spiritual identity.
So there you go. So he was operating from delusion, and maybe the woman in samadhi was so wise about delusion that she knows not to respond to it. So to be enlightened about delusion means you don't get caught by it or pushed around by it. So why did she respond to the other bodhisattva, the one who was called the wisdom about delusion?
I think in line with that, what I was thinking is that the first person was coming from a place of lacking knowledge or lacking peace, uh-huh. and almost demanding, maybe from a desperate place almost, wanting her attention. And the bodhisattva who came when she bowed, she immediately showed respect. And to me, it was a mere request or suggestion to come out of it.
Nice. So maybe the bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjushri, was insecure because he'd been left out of the conference of the Buddhas. Like, Manjushri is like the highest kind of like bodhisattva, just short of a Buddha. So it's like pretty good, right? So he's... but, you know, he's still not fully enlightened, so he still has some foibles. And more of them, maybe some insecurity that he was left out, and sitting right in the right hand side of the Buddha should be him, but there's a woman, and so that really stirred him up. So he was, so maybe he was insecure or arrogant or caught in those things. But the woman who came earlier out of the ground, she didn't have that. She had the respect.
Yes, and I think the woman came out because she was more in harmony with a suggestion rather than a demand.
She came out of samadhi because she was in harmony with the request rather than a demand. Nice. I like that. Thank you. Can you pass it over there?
I wasn't really sure that I understood that the whole part about what was happening in that situation for him, but what struck me about the story is that he had this expectation that it should have been a man sitting there. And instead what he found was a woman. And so often it struck me, there's a parallel there for me anyway, that so often you're looking for something and you think it's going to be in a certain place and it's not actually in that place. I call it looking for shoes in a bakery. You keep going to that place and you keep looking and you think it's going to be there. And you suddenly, and I think that that's what I got, is that this man saw her sitting there and thought, but that's not where it should be. That's not the right store. That's not the right place.
Nice.
So he, I think that was the delusion that he woke up from, because it's so often in a place where you least expect it rather than in a place where you do expect it.
Nice. So the Bodhisattva wisdom had an expectation of how things should be, and it didn't work. But the woman who came out of the ground, she respectfully paid her respect and sat down in front of the woman in samadhi. And the idea of sitting down in Buddhism also has the sense of, like in meditation, you just sit there and you're open to what comes. And she was maybe she was going to be willing to stay there and be open for however long it took.
I mean, how many times do we go running and looking for something that we want in, you know, and we think it's going to definitely be in that place or definitely be from that person.
Yeah.
And he found out that, you know, that his expectation was, it was a different source.
Great, very nice, thank you. So behind you, Camille. Oh, right behind.
I was struck by how he lifted her up into the air. It just seems like such a controlling gesture and also like so dramatic, kind of getting at what you were saying before about like, well, enlightenment is this powerful, fancy, magical thing. And, you know, and that just had no effect on her. Whereas the Bodhisattva, the wisdom about delusion comes up from the ground, like seems so humble to be somebody who's normally you don't even see because she's below the ground and connected to the grounding. And then, you know, all she does is humbly bow and then snap her finger. She doesn't have to do something so fancy.
Nice. Very nice. The a little bit, you know, going aside, but what you're saying reminded me of why one of the reasons I was so impressed by my first Zen teacher, Mel Weitzman, was that he was so ordinary. And you know, if you saw him in the supermarket, you wouldn't think much of, you know, it wouldn't occur to you that he's a Zen teacher.
Yeah, my Zen teacher in LA likes to say, in our practice we become ordinary, but what you think of as ordinary is actually really deluded.
Yes, please. There's straight back behind you, Phil.
what interested me when the second Bodhisattva came up, my inclination would have been to just sit in front of the woman in samadhi and not make a request for her to leave it. Why bring her out of that state as opposed to just be with her?
I think the motivation to get her out of there was to ask her why she was sitting there. Who are you to sit there? in the story, at least, that's, you know. But I appreciate your, you know, your respectful way of sitting there with her. Very nice.
So I was struck by just what you said, Gil, which was the initial question is, what is she doing there? What is she doing there? And of course, she was doing nothing there. She was being there, right? And she was being there in this deep state of samadhi. And she was teaching. She was a teacher, I think.
By just being.
Just by being there. Yeah.
So how often are we asked to be accountable? What are you doing? Or we feel like we have to be accountable. I have to prove to people I'm worthy, I'm doing something, and, you know, and I have to sit and meditate, and people say, what are you doing? You could be doing important things. there's television programs to watch. Yes, Gus.
I thought some about the Buddha and how this whole thing played out, in that he allowed the Bodhisattva to just try to get the woman out of samadhi, right? Just let him do that, right? And then suggested, well, let's have wisdom about delusion come up. And it struck me kind of as a lesson also for the first Bodhisattva, in the sense that he was actually encouraging this thing to play out and suggested the wisdom about delusion come up, right? And the lesson that I get from it also is that wisdom on its own is not enough. You have to be, that true wisdom is knowing both sides at the same time, the wisdom and the delusion.
Nice.
So the first one was only wisdom, and he was not quite there yet, where wisdom about delusion brought something else to learn, which is it has to be those two.
Okay, very nice. Wisdom about delusion makes it real in our lives much more. When I was thinking about the story earlier, I remembered, I got involved in Buddhism and Zen in my early 20s, and there were a lot of other men in the early 20s in my scene at the time. I think some of the times the conversations were all about the subtle nature of emptiness, you know, enlightenment and the true nature of existence and reality and ultimate reality, and a little bit idealistic, and with no grounding in the world that we live, kind of apart from it almost. And so a little bit that way, that, you know, it wasn't a delving into this world and delusion, understanding how we act and behave, but rather it's, kind of apart from it, as if it could be apart. Very nice. Great, thank you for that. It was great to have your responses. The Zen masters would have been very happy with you engaging with it. So, this Zen master Dogen, who made this quote, wrote this piece about that Buddhas are enlightened about delusion, and foolish people are deluded about enlightenment. In the same work, he has a very nice very very nice little quotes in this famous piece of his, and one of them says, to care about delusion, to carry oneself forward and recognize things in the world is delusion. So to bring oneself forward, to assert oneself forward into the world, and to be the one who recognizes what's happening is delusion. That's the first half. The second half is to allow all things to come forth and reveal themselves is awakening. So two different ways of operating. So one way is asserting oneself and using oneself as the measure for what we want, what has to happen, what we're going to do, using one's own criteria for recognizing and deciding what's there. And the other is a willingness to kind of be open and allowing reality to show itself, allowing reality to bubble up and just reveal itself. And there are two different modes of being. And I think in Buddhism, that divide is likened to the divide between being attached something to something, and not being attached, not clinging. Because to move yourself forward, the way it says actually the word works is to go forward with the self. So your self-identity, you know, your little self, the idea of me, myself, and mine, I have to prove myself, I have to attain something, I have to get something, I. There's very little room sometimes when there's a bigger preoccupation with me, myself, and mine for reality to kind of unfold and open and show itself. And the reality that opens, that comes forth, is not only the world around us, but also the reality within us, the life within us. And one of the beautiful things to discover in practice is, I think it's one of the profound things, is how much wisdom, how much beauty, how much process of healing and unfolding can happen if we create the conditions to allow it to come forth and move through us. And if we are in charge, if we think it's up to us, it's only up to our efforts, only up to our proving ourselves or defining ourselves or getting what we want, we actually limit the space in the heart or the inside for something to bubble up, to swell up, to move through us in a beautiful, in a wonderful way. So, and also around us in the world. If we are the ones who assert ourselves and say, this is how it has to be, then there's not space to allow something else to come. And I think we had a little demonstration of this just here in this Dharma talk. Because if I, with all my wisdom, infinite wisdom, like, you know, like Manjushri, had I had just kind of gone forth and explained to you what the story really meant, I think we all would have been limited by that, you know, my ideas. But I felt enriched by the fact that I opened it up and to hear from all you and get different perspectives. And I heard perspectives I hadn't thought about. So I was delighted to have these understanding come forth and be revealed in this room, in this situation. And you know, today we have this Earth Care fair. And we have the story of the woman coming out of the earth that got revealed. I think that in how this plays itself out with the environment is that if we are self-centered as human beings and it's all about our desires and our comfort and what we want, and we're asserting ourselves in our life and our lifestyle on the planet, that's a certain kind of delusion. It might bring comfort, it might bring a sense of safety to us, it might bring some kind of things that we feel good having all that power and whatever we do, but it also limits us, and it limits our planet. It kind of confines things. It doesn't allow for things to come forth and reveal themselves. And, you know, we live in a beautiful planet, a beautiful nature, where I think that it's pretty simple to say that human beings have limited dramatically the natural unfolding, the natural world's revelation of how things unfold and grow. You know, an amazing, dramatic degree over these last 150 years. But other times in human civilization, they've done it as well. I grew up little part of my upbringing was on the Adriatic coast in Italy. And all the way, it used to be Yugoslavia, down the coast there is Yugoslavia. We used to go down to visit sometimes. Beautiful, beautiful islands that the Romans had completely denuded. There used to be trees and forests and soils there. And now they're just, you know, they were kind of beautiful, but they were bare rocks, you know, everything. Most of the plants are gone because there's, you know, the deforestation that happened in the ancient world. But, you know, so we have animals disappearing, we have plants disappearing, we have whole ecologies disappearing. The natural world that unfolded and grew up to be in harmony and homeostasis and all this profound way in which things are in balance has gotten disturbed in our planet because of human activity and human desires and human consumption. So is some of that delusion? Some of it has to do with just the sheer number of human beings, you know, and the aggregate of it all, just the planet can't handle it. But I think there's a fair amount of what Buddhism would call delusion or clinging or desire. And to learn not to assert oneself all the time, but to learn this radical other thing of allowing things to come forth on their own is one of the profound, beautiful things I think comes from practice. And I think it allows for a wiser way of living in the world. I think it supports us being content with what we have rather than having to change and get and improve and do, you know, in order to, you know, consume more, or get more friends, or have more Facebook connections. You know, all this doing, all this wanting, all this kind of building, creating, and creating a sense of self, and showing oneself, improving oneself, and apologizing for oneself, and doing all the self thing that we do, limits us. And it isn't like necessarily that it's bad to do it, but one of the really great things is to appreciate how much delusion and clinging limits things. Limits the a wonderful, free movement of the heart, of the mind, of the world around us, the free movement of the connection to the world. And so to learn this step of getting out of the way, of allowing things to reveal themselves, to come forth on their own, can begin in meditation practice itself. To start becoming wise about how we are not doing that, how we get in the way of the free flow, how we interfere, how we're trying to control, how we're trying to avoid, how we're trying to fix, how we're trying to attain something. All that's to understand how we do that is the wisdom about delusion. If we're in a hurry to get concentrated, get into samadhi, if we're in a hurry to get completely full of loving kindness and emptiness and cosmic consciousness or whatever, you know, wonderful states, without doing the work of understanding the delusion and how we get caught and what we're doing, then we're only seeing half the picture. For this wisdom of Buddhism to be portable and to be applicable in all ways takes a willingness to recognize what we're doing that delimits, that holds down our experience in who we are, our delusion, our clinging, our attachments we have. And to be able to look at it with honesty and humility and okayness. It's not you're not a bad person because you have clinging. Look at me. I'm clinging. And, you know, but then hopefully we're not caught by that or asserting that on top of other people. But, you know, admit, look, you know, I'm doing the best I can and I have this foible, I have this thing that I do, and I'm trying to look at it and understand it. And then by looking at it and understanding it, going through it, that's the wisdom of delusion. And then your wisdom, I think, is much more stable, is much more usable, much more realistic in this world. So I encourage you, if I may, to allow the wisdom about delusion to emerge in you. Not just wisdom. Become a student of delusion. Become a student of clinging. And be happy. So we have a couple of minutes. Any comments on that anyone would like to make? Yes, please. Could you wait for the mic, please?
So I'm raised in an Asian society, Japanese, and they always say, you know, don't speak out. You know, you need to speak less. But I think what this fair is about is advocacy, activism, speaking out, not waiting for it to happen.
Yes.
And I think that there's somewhere a little edge where you take the wisdom of Buddha, but at the same time you realize that not everything can be done. If the whole world were Buddhistic, yes, but it isn't. There are times that you need to speak out.
Yes, I agree. So, Buddhist cultures, and I think Japanese is very much influenced by Buddhism and other kind of religions, there's a lot of wisdom that's embedded in these cultures, quite beautiful. But there's also, if it's done too much or too blindly or too idealistically, it has its limitations as well. And so this idea that you don't speak out, you kind of don't stand out, is in some Asian cultures is kind of like you're not supposed to stand out and be be different from everybody else. You're supposed to fit into the group. It's a beautiful value in the right context. But if it ends up allowing things to come forth and reveal themselves also includes our desire for social change, also includes a desire to improve this world so that people don't suffer, and does include a rising of strong voices and a willingness to take a stand. And so sometimes that gets limited. And so different cultures have, always kind of, sometimes you can never kind of get the sweet spot. And cultures are kind of, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left. And I think the kind of popular American culture that we're most familiar with, perhaps, tends to swing a little bit too much in the self's individual assertion side. And perhaps Japanese culture is one of those that swings a little bit more to the other side, maybe. But we need both. Is that the fair response, or is that okay with you, what I said, or do you want to say something more?
No. I thought you were basically... I mean, I do agree that in Buddhism, if everyone was in sync, the world would be better.
Uh-huh.
But I also know on the other side of that dissonance has its place. And that it's truthful and beautiful as well. But sometimes I feel that Buddhism is used as a way of controlling the culture.
It is. It's true. Every religion is used. Cultures, the people in power will use whatever's available. And so in Buddhist culture, sometimes they use Buddhism. So you have to be aware of this. And cultures always have their shadow side. And so Buddhism as a culture has its shadow side, its challenges. It's the function of the practice to bring out the shadow so we can see the delusion. And so ideally we have both. We can't avoid having a culture. IMC has a little bit of a culture. But we also have a practice. And hopefully the practice somehow corrects for any of the limitations of the culture. So the practice is important. And now I hope that, my own hope is that Buddhist practice develops very mature individuals who at the same time as being kind of ordinary, not asserting themselves, their ego, they're also can take very strong stands in our society and stand for things that are important, need to be done. That we're not pushovers and, oh, it's all okay. And one of the things I like is, I'm actually quite fond of certain kind of conflicts because conflict is actually a wonderful way of there's an art to staying and not avoiding conflict, but staying in conflict in a respectful, useful way. That if we can stay in conflict sometimes, then sometimes a solution comes out that is more wise, more brilliant than if we didn't stay in the conflict. And I've seen that many, many times, like a disagreement about what should happen, and one person says A, and I say B, and we're at loggerheads, and I say, they're ready to say, no, I give up, whatever you want. I say, no, don't do that. This is really important. You have a really important point, and this is really great, and I have an important point, and let's engage and see what happens. And then after a while, it turns out that Z is the right answer, not A or B. So I think that, avoiding conflict is not, sometimes is a problem. But knowing how to be in conflict wisely, have differences wisely, is part of the art of it. So we have this wonderful Earth Care Fair, and people have brought their examples of their concerns and work and what they do, and it's a chance to... it's a beautiful thing. This says, come forth. We're just sitting here quietly at IMC, and what comes forth is our community has come forward with their offerings for us to learn a little bit about this. So if you have time to stay, please stay and have tea and hang out. And I thank you all.